say something so Philip knows you're here.
Hey, I'm here. Something. You're here too. We're live. Everything.
Yeah. We're watching.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. We actually are live. we are beginning to dig into the text of Judges once again. We want to thank everyone for being part of the study. We have some really interesting parts of the text of Judges to open up for our study this morning. We're thankful for everyone who has joined in. Jared, why don't you kind of get things started off while I do a one more level of technical stuff to kind of bring people into things?
Yeah, Philip has basically been shoveling things off on me randomly when he needed to fix things. So this is, I have to admit, one of my favorite sections of the Book of Judges. We get this dual account, poetry and prose. We get these really cool characters. There's a lot of literary stuff going on. There's a lot of practical stuff going on. There's all these different interactions. So it's, and in some ways, it's a high point in the Book of Judges. Of course, as we would expect in this dumpster flyer floating down the river, as Phil has thrown into our introductory graphic, there are some really troubling things going on here. But this is such a testimony to how God is and how God works and what God does that I think that we'll get a lot out of it. I think there's a lot going on there that should increase our faith and increase our understanding of who God is and how he interacts with his people.
So we've got in the text here a couple of things that are kind of interesting. And we're going to begin with talking about two or three of them before we actually get into the scriptures. We're going to read parts of chapter 4 and chapter 5. So one of the first things that's interesting is that just like the larger instructive block of Judges, there's two parts to the history of Deborah and Barak. And so in the larger textual block, you've got like two cycles. You've got the first half and the second half that show the gradual transition from Israel being of Jehovah to Israel being Canaan, and it goes through two sections there. But here, as we kind of narrow it smaller, there are two types of instruction in the Deborah and Barak records. And I want to kind of identify a couple of interesting aspects of it. And so we've got two sections, one's prose, one's poetry. Most readers of the Bible and most folks who are interested in literary context are already kind of familiar with these methods. In the Old Testament, you've got songs and poetry that appear in many of the letters or any of the segments of it from Genesis all the way up to the last prophet of the Old Testament, John. You've got a lot of the literary pictures, the prophets themselves, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, they use these big word pictures a lot. But then you get more narrow and you think about the Psalms, the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Those have a high poetic instructive style. And so they teach through poetry, much in the same way that you have two different comparative genres to think about. A lot of folks really enjoy the science fiction, fantasy, novel brackets. And I do too. I mean, I've read a ton of authors over the years that kind of fit into those bunches from Cormac McCarthy, who is dystopian, kind of slightly historical, but more of a futurist. You've got McCaffrey, you've got Robert Jordan, Tolkien, et cetera. Those are big power names, as well as folks who use those type of story things and write their new stories. And that kind of thing is one type. And then you also have full-on nonfiction, historical nonfiction, which can teach the same genres, but it's real people, real places, real things. Both of them teach. And so to think about these two chapters is to think about that in the same way. One is using poetry and prose to teach. The other one is doing more of a nonfiction approach to teach. And they both teach. Now, the advantage for it in this text is it gives you different tools that you can use to be instructive with. You can teach through prose in a different way than you teach through poetic terms. And so we do that a lot. And here's another Americanized edition of it. Just think of the Star-Spangled Banner. It's not really history, but it kind of is because it comes out of history. And so that's another way to think about it. Jared?
Yeah, and this is neat because it's one of the few places in the Bible we get both a poetic and a prose account of the same thing. I mean, other than this, other than a few Psalms kind of giving us the history of David, it's basically this and then Exodus chapters 14 and 15 with the Song at Sea. And what Judges chapter 5 does is it really gets kind of does the emotional situations. It provides us all these different insights into what characters are thinking. And that's really, really impactful, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But it also, in this text, we kind of move from that level of there's two accounts or two records of the same setting to a next level of that, is to think about what's going on in this particular text. And it requires for us to take a little bit of time to talk about a related subject. And that, for right now, is the place and presence of women in the Old Testament story, narrative, teaching blocks of the Old Testament. When we go from the garden, they're there. It's a two-part account there. You move through from that point forward. We say patriarchs, but it's more about families. Patriarch's not really the best way to use it, but it's just a structural term. But very often the matriarchs in those families drive the story more than the patriarchs by their choices and how they interact with God. And Edwin's right. Poetic isn't fictional. It's poetic. It's taking a real count and turning into a literary form. And so that's a good point, Edwin. Thank you. Moving through the story of God's developing plans, women are always integral to it, and they work in different roles. And they're not just there as window dressing. They are very significant components to teaching us what God wants us to know. Jerry, why don't you walk through some of that from some of the literary side of things, language side, before we get into our next chunk of the text and teaching.
Yeah, one thing that's really, I think, important to think and remember about that is that the Bible's culture of women is not the same as the culture in which the Bible is written. We have to remember these are very different things, that how the Bible treats women. And we can see that, I think, more clearly in the book of Judges because it has so many more named female characters with important roles than any other text of the Bible. And one of the key aspects of the book of Judges is show how the culture doesn't match of the biblical characters doesn't match what the Bible actually says. The Bible treats women as just as important and just as valuable as men. But what we're going to see in the book of Judges is nobody in here does. And that is going to drive so much of the action from the beginning until the end. And we see that super clearly in chapters 4 and chapter 5 with how particularly the characters of Deborah and Sisera's mother and Jael are treated.
Yeah, and if you can think about it historically, that same illustration takes place in the United States. If you go in the contrast of the Quakers and the Shakers and other isolationist type gender separated groups, all the way over to two different types of segments that occur in those same time frames where everything is male dominant or everything is female dominant evangelical corners, Pentecostal corners, even amongst churches of Christ, there's actually groups that fit both of those things where there's some churches in the southern portion of California in those same eras took on a very matriarchal leadership context where women drove everything. And then you also find ones where the opposite is true in these same things where women were ignored because there's the Bible and then there's how people use or interpret the Bible. And those are two different things in a lot of places. So digging into the text, we got two chapters. As much as we would love to sit and talk about this all morning, we do want to get moving forward in our reading and our study. So let's talk our way into chapter 4. There's some of the things that we can storytell a little bit, but there's parts of chapter 4 and parts of chapter 5 that we want to pause and just read the text deeply. So, Jared, why don't you bring us in verses 1 through 11. Actually, I'll kind of start this, and then you can get ready to read, say, verse 12 or so, and we'll kind of bounce the ball back and forth at that point. So we move off of chapter 3. We've had our three initial notified judges. These are individuals, we've got Shamgar, Ehud, Othniel. They are the first three serving in the spiral that works itself down to its ultimate conclusion at the end of the text. They go through their individual cycles of spiritual rebellion. So you have that combo. And then verse 1, chapter 4, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And so now we have a shift. And notice that two things have happened here. One, the picture has shifted from a smaller segment back to the tribes as a whole. The terminology that's used here is moving off of one tribe or one region and back to the big picture. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And so now, again, the visual, let's see everything, let's recognize everything, opens up to a bigger picture. They cry out to the Lord for help. You see the oppression that takes place. And verse 4, this is an important point to make. I think we'll kind of leave from this point and then jump into the deeper parts of the story in a second. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. Question number one for all of us is Deborah a judge?
Unlike what you'll hear from people like Stephen Kuffel, absolutely. Now, she doesn't have the same term of savior that we see, but she's one of the only people in the entire story we actually see doing something that's like a judge and not just like a warlord.
Right.
But there's even more going on in this specific text because it hyper-emphasizes her gender. It's not just a prophetess. It doesn't use the female form of Nevi, the prophet. It says a lady prophet,
The
wife of Lapidoth. So it emphasizes her gender here, and we know that's going to be really important, but there's something else going on that's really neat because it's contrasting their names. So a lot of people know that Barak, his name means thunder. Well, Lapidoth, his name means lightning. Okay, so you've got these two guys with names of thunder and lightning. And we're like, oh man, these guys are going to be important. No, they're not. Instead, it's going to be Deborah, whose name probably means bee. You know, this is actually the most common Greek name for a woman comes from the term for bee. And that's because she's supposed to be quiet and busy about the home, not spoken, not heard of. And yet, how do we see this situation going up? And it's also a pun because her name is also very close in sound to the term for chariot driver. Well, who's Sisera, this major chariot commander, and she's going to drive him off. So we have even in the names of the Bible, God's like, here, this is going to be important.
Yeah. And here's something important. Sometimes we make mistakes in determining the theological significance of a person by bad interpretations of their names. Names in the Bible are all over the place. But when they appear in poetry and prose, in the context of structured, inspired text, it still is important for us to pause and think, okay, now what is God doing? What is he trying to teach us? Is this name important? Well, when he makes a play of the names and there's these obvious kind of subversions of what you expect and what you get, you're expecting this to happen, but you actually get this other thing over there. I think it's really important to kind of pause and see that because we're going to see that in this story too. There are some literary connections to the names of the participant that match the events that unfold around them, much in the same way as, I don't know, maybe the sons of thunder that we encounter in the New Testament or the stories of Jesus as he goes to places and people expect one thing and he gives them an entirely different thing. So let's go ahead and read some. I think it's probably a good point to introduce, chapter 4, I think we talked about, verses 12 through 22, and just read the text and let the whole chunk of it take place.
Sure. Now, when Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him from Haroshet Hagoyim, the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, up! For this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all of his chariots and all of his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and he fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Haroshet Hagoyim. And all of the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, so not a man was left. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the white in the house of Hever, the Kenite. And Jael came out to Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my lord. Turn into me. Do not be afraid. So he turned aside to her, and he went into the tent. And she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, please give me a little water drink, for I'm thirsty. But she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, is anyone here? Say no. But Jael, the wife of Hever, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. And then she went softly to him and drove the tent peg into his temple until it went all the way into the ground while he was laying fast asleep from weariness, and he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said, come, and I will show you the man you're seeking. So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan.
All right, so a couple of things that are going to really be important to lay out here. We're going to move into chapter 5 in a second, because there's some details in the poetic section that really aren't explained or opened up in the prose account, as we're kind of arbitrarily designating each of these two parts. So looking at chapter 4, just kind of narrowing our focus there, Jared, there's a couple of terms or words that are used here that are important for the what does God want us to know side of the conversation. So what are some key words you would highlight in on maybe two or three to start with, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the text after that.
Yeah, well, we have the same things with names playing out in this text, too. And throughout all of Judges, and really throughout all the Bible, names are pretty important. I mean, Nabal is Nabal because he is a fool, right? But here, Hever means ally. And, of course, here we have this other person who he flees here because he thinks he's going to be safe. But, of course, he's not going to be safe. But we have also this Jabin, who we've seen before, this king of Canaan, Hazor. This is another one of those cities that I asked Phil about way back in the beginning when I knew he was working on something else. This is one of the major areas Joshua where God triumphs over the people. But here we have another king named Jabin, also in Hazor, and the point is not, oh, well, what's going on here? It means that what those events that happened in Joshua chapter 11, verses 1 through 15, although God gave Hazor into their hands and they burn it to the ground, and you can still see that huge ash layer today, they didn't keep the land. They gave it back. There's another Jabin who's also suppressing them in the same way as before. And God is going to use Deborah here to bring about a victory. And the interaction there with Barak, because, of course, he doesn't want to go until she's willing to go. And then we see that God drives him into the tent of this woman, and it's not even Barak who's going to get the victory. It's not him who's going to have the honor of killing this major general, because he, of course, wasn't willing to go up without a woman's help. And that's shaming in this culture.
Right. And these are things that are super important to understand, because God is using this story to teach us a number of what we might say broadly biblical truths, but just simple truths. We can get hung up on our own individual limitations. We can get hung up on our I want to, I can't, I'm not willing, I should, I shouldn't level of understanding. But in the end, we see God using an uncommon person to do something that should have been not even on the table to begin with. All of this is due to the failure of Israel to keep the covenant and to follow God's expectations while in the covenant land. And so now you're seeing all this high level of brokenness. There's a lot of brokenness that is being put on display here. Broken men and broken women, by the way. The text of Judges will show us an equal number of painful interactions, because not everyone's righteous. In fact, it's pretty rare utterance in Judges. Not everyone's good, not everyone's moral, and not everyone's kind, especially when it opens up these wounds in this section of the text, too. Side note, Just again, if you're watching and you want to ask a question, make a comment, please do so. We'll try to bring those in. We've got folks who are joining the Bible study from all the way across the whole lower 48 at this point. I don't think Alaska and Hawaii are awake just yet. So
I hope not.
Who knows? It's cold up there. But we're very thankful that you're here and joining in the Bible study. Jared, what else do we need to pay attention to in the latter section of the story that drives an understanding level before we get into maybe more explaining the bigger picture of things? Is there anything else?
One thing that you've been bringing up a lot, so I'll let you drop your catchphrase here. What do you say about theology there, Philip?
Well, all good theology grows from the seeds planted in the Garden of Eden is the long form sentence. That's where bad theology comes from, too, but that's where good theology finds its beginning points.
Well, we see the garden here, right? Because remember what happens in Genesis 3 is you've got Adam and Eve there as the serpent is talking to them. And who is supposed to be ruling? Well, it's Adam.
Yeah.
But of course, who steps up to rule? And of course, that's not in a good way. Who is it?
Well, Eve does. She steps up and says, "Oh, that looks good." Listens to the serpent. There's a lot more stuff going on there in that part of the interaction. But yeah, she oversees her bounds.
Yeah, but what do we see here? Why does Deborah have to oversee her bounds? Is it because she just does that on her own?
No, she's playing a role. I mean, she's judging Israel at this point, even though she's the bee who should be quiet and busy.
Who should be doing this?
Yeah, you know, it's obvious that it's not, well, not just everybody else, but Barak for sure. But there's other aspects of it. He's just the person on the table today. In the judges' fall, if you will.
Yeah. But this just continues on the same thing, right? Just as we have an Edomite with Othniel being the person who shouldn't be in charge of Judah but is, now we have a person in charge of this multi-tribal alliance, and it's supposed to be Barak. But it can't be because he won't do his job. And now Deborah has to step up and do it. And Jael is going to have to step up and do it. And that's just what we're going to see over and over and over in Judges. And at first, it's like, okay, men are failing to do their job, so women are stepping up and being leaders. But soon, that's not going to be enough. Men aren't going to step up, but they don't want the women to step up either, so they're going to end up sacrificing them and dismembering them and sending them out throughout the tribes.
And this is a good point right now before we get into at least a couple more things to bring back up the funnel. And so we've got the funnel brought back, or the fatal funnel. I think that's the name I've settled on, the current iteration of it. And you'll notice in the spiral that goes downward of Israel proper, we've got the comparative connections. And so we've got Deborah and Barak on one level of the edge. And across the ring, if you will, what's our other pairs? We've got Abimelech, Zair, and my little text is really small, so I can't read everything.
Tola. Yeah.
Tola, that's right. I make notes, but I'm old. I can't see everything anymore as much. But you'll notice, if you remember, you think about some of those stories and what takes place there, there's going to be some bouncing points where, hey, wait, this same thing kind of happened over here. But over here, it was worse. It was bad when I first saw it, because it's bad here, but it's worse down the road, too. All right, so from the narrative side in the prose of chapter 4, we see kind of how this plays out. But now it moves into chapter 5, and we've got that prose setting account, if you will. What do we need to pay attention here? Because we're going to be picking up, say, reading verse 24 through the end of the chapter. What is it that we're going to be walking into with the additional insights here, Jared?
Yeah, so chapter 5 expects that we already know the historical account of chapter 4. It's doing different things, and because it relies on that, it's kind of like when you read the Gospel of John. John expects that we know the other Gospels in some form already, and he can do different things because of that. So this chapter 5 expects that we kind of know the story. And it's the main purpose of chapter 5 is to bring honor and shame to people depending on how they react. So it straight up calls out the tribes who don't show up to help, right? Like, it blames them for what they do and what they don't do. It praises those tribes who do show up and shames those who don't. We have Shamgar, you know, your favorite judge who gets a nod here, that we know that these two groups are happening at the same time, even though, of course, Shamgar isn't in this situation. So we get the tribes called out We get the people who are honored and the people who are ashamed, made sure that everybody remembers who showed up and who didn't for the rest of history. I mean, that's pretty neat, right? I mean, this is, you know, the Old Testament version, I guess, in some ways, of the great cloud of witnesses in Hebrews.
So Edwin brings up a great question. He says, mentioning the garden, I've been listening to a series of podcasts that link many stories that mention trees back to the garden. If this is supposed to point us back to the garden, does mentioning the oak in Zananim, Hebrew, I can pronounce any way I want because I am not a Hebrew scholar, in 4:11 present a pointer to the garden also, or is that too much parallelism?
Okay, first of all, Edwin, we all know you're watching the Bible Project videos, okay? So good job. Those are very good. The answer is yes, in a weirdly uncomfortable way. This is the term for a sacred oak. It's actually a high place, which is troubling for several different ways. If you're more interested in that, we can definitely dive into that a little deeper. But the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
It is linked to this problematic question of the garden. And just as at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we have this man-woman interaction where the man fails, we have one here too.
Yeah. I'll add this, since I know that Edwin is most likely, I'm not going to completely out that, but most likely he's watching the Bible Project videos. They're very good. I'm rewatching the Spiritual Being ones. I would introduce like the introduction to it is a great way to see this big picture of the theology of the garden as it represents the entire spiritual genre of how God teaches. And for the congregation at Eastside, a lot of our congregation is familiar with some of the Bible Project stuff because we've used parts of it in different Bible studies already. And if you haven't, I don't think we're in competition with the Bible Project by any means.
No, not even a little bit.
And so I think there is a lot going on there. It's good to see some of the friends from the local area too. Jim Williams, who I know pretty well, is from our area joining in for our Bible study a little bit. And so let's go ahead and scooch in to a next chunk of the text and read for it, because that'll help us kind of make some more points too. There's some things I want to bring up in this closing narrative section. So verse 24, I think. Jared, you want to pick up reading there in chapter 5?
Sure thing. Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Hever the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women most blessed. He asked for water, she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She sent her hand to the tent peg, and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera, she crushed his head, she shattered and pierced his temple. Between her legs he sank, he fell, he lay still. Between her legs he sank, he fell, and where he sank, there he fell dead. Out of the window she peered. The mother of Sisera wailed through the lattice. Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariots? Her wisest attendants answer. Indeed, she answers herself. Have they not found and divided the spoil? A woman or two for every man. Spoil of dyed materials for Sisera, spoil of dyed materials embroidered, 2 pieces of dyed work embroidered for the neck as spoil. So may all of your enemies perish, O Lord, but your friends be like the sun as he rises in his might. And the land had rest for 40 years.
All right, so if you didn't catch, this is, at least in more puritanized cultures like America can be about the Bible, really uncomfortable and weird from what a lot of people are comfortable with in describing conflict and death of enemies, because they're literally praising the methodology of the death of Sisera here. And there's certainly some, and I'll say this really quick, in the text of Judges, there's a lot of stuff that is intentionally designed to make you wonder, is that really what is going on there? There's stuff that's intentionally designed to make you visualize the event. And the poetry sections really heighten that. The poetry sections make it even more intense. There's a lot going on here in the language. Let's back it up. Verse 24, the expanded, you know, most blessed of women, BJL. A couple things take place. What's JL's lineage?
So we have here, again, another non-Israelite rising to save Israel.
Yeah.
I mean, we should expect this. This happens all the time in what we're reading in the book of Judges. The Israelites are worse than the Canaanites in a lot of ways. And so here we have this person who comes off the scene. She's what we would consider a non-combatant. She's a woman of the ally of the enemy. And yet she's going to become the hero. And she's going to become the one who's most blessed among women. There, Edwin has brought up, you know, crushed his head. Is this like the serpent? Well, who do we read as most blessed among women in the New Testament?
Yeah.
And Mary.
Yeah.
Right?
Super obvious clock went on and said, hey, pay attention to things that are really, really obvious because there's no ambiguity about it. And there's some other things, too, especially in chapter 4, that if you read closely, you'll notice some interactions between Sisera and JL that are pretty on point in a slow, careful reading.
On point?
Yes, on point. It's really hard for me not to use all my puns. There's a lot of puns in Judges, which, by the way, is Judges is written with that high level of linguistic interplay. A pun is basically word plays, and Judges is a giant word play from chapter 1 to the end, just about.
Yeah, it's some of the highest literary Hebrew in the Old Testament, which is something that is wonderful when if anybody, you know, has a chance to learn Hebrew, to read Hebrew. The book of Judges is a joy to read.
Yeah. I think my side note, Edwin made a comment about the stuff from the Bible Project. Hebrew is not my strong suit by any means. Like, I can make bad translations. That's the accurate level of my Hebrew. And even then, that's kind of, low order skills. Greek is a little stronger for me. But what I love to do is there's a lot of great readings of the Old Testament in Hebrew and listen to the sounds of the text that I read in my translation. And so I find YouTube has a ton of them. There's a bazillion of people reading the Old Testament in Hebrew. Listen to it while you read your English translation. It brings out things that, even if you're not familiar with the text, can become really important. Doy throws a pun for us. I'm going to go ahead and bring it in. Temple imagery. Yeah, that's dad level 12.
Yeah.
Side note about JL, she's a woman who is now also not of Israel. So there's a double.
It's
step,
a double. Yeah.
Or in Chris Emerson speak, you know, level 2 as opposed to level 1, you know, using his methodology. All right. So even in the way she's praised, there are some pictures here that are gender specific, that are unique to her, the methodology of his demise, her positioning, all of this stuff is designed to elicit some contrast, because if Sisera was a great king, where should he have died?
In battle.
Right.
To a man.
Yeah. And that's not the case at all. And what kind of person is JL? Like, what's her employment status to kind of connect some other biblical allusions to it? Do we know anything about her?
We don't really know anything about her. I mean, this story, as we saw in the Fatal Funnel, is connected, of course, to Abimelech. How does Abimelech die? Do you remember?
Abimelech is killed by a woman too. I mean, it's the same.
With what? Do you remember?
I do not right now.
A roof tile. Guess where it strikes him? Guess where it strikes him?
Yeah, the head.
In the temple, right. And remember when he says, oh, I can't be killed by a woman. Someone else kill me. Hurry. I don't want to be shamed like this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is the same story, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's this additional level here that's going on, because we have these two women played out, and one is JL and one is Sisera's mom. And in this victory taunt, because that's what it is, which can kind of be uncomfortable, as you said, to these Western audiences, there is the text is requiring us to consider, how is it that JL gets him in this situation at all? And we see that also on the other side of why Sisera's mom thinks that he's taking so long to come home. And why does she think that he's taking so long to come home?
Well, it's kind of hinted at. It's like he's been doing something, and that's the kind of the thing. The picturing there is that he's gone to a place that has nothing to do with fighting. He's A, hiding, or B, satisfying his natural desires. I mean, that's really what the pictures are there. There's some wordplay in there that can really be of importance. But also kind of like there's another layer to this. If we scoot forward in the text and we pay attention to verse 28 in the passage, she's not really concerned with what he has been doing, just whether he's going to come back.
She comforts herself by thinking, hey, he's despoiling people and despoiling women. My good boy. That's why he's so slow coming back. He's doing these terrible things to these people.
Yeah. You know, and there's a lot that goes on in that picture. So let's kind of like tie all these pieces together. We've got a whole bundle of facts now that lay out the basic structure of the story. Have literary aspects, names, places, historical aspects, names, places. God's trying to teach us stuff, because each of these stories in the fall of Israel into Canaan should be teaching us things. And so this is the point where we want to give an understanding to the text, more so than just the joke, one's nailed, one's stoned, in regards to the death of these horrible men. So what are some of the stuff that God wants us to know? Like, if we kind of go back to our basic five questions, thinking through all of this, what do I want to know more? What's some observations? What do I like about this particular story? What does God teach me about himself or me? So what do we got here? By the way, if you've got observations, you can throw them in the chat, too. We'll bring them into the closing parts of the class.
Well, I think one thing that we've seen that Edwin's already kind of emphasized throughout is we have these scenes, that this aspect of this text of Judges is midway in a lot of ways between the text of Genesis 3 and the text of Jesus and Mary. That here we have these trees and the garden and the question of how are you going to gain victory over your enemy? Is it going to be through seizing power or refusing to take power like Adam does in the situation there with Deborah and Barak? Is it going to be by crushing the head of your enemy like Jael does? But how does Mary crush the head in through Jesus, right? How is this feasible? It's through her submission to God, right? It's through her, but she issues her own victory taunt to the enemies, right? Just like Hannah does. So this is a type, an echo, a foreshadowing of Christ, and it's a foreshadowing of God's ultimate victory over sin and over those things that abuse us. And are we going to be part of that salvation effort by serving God and obeying him? Are we instead going to see what is good in our own eyes and seize it for ourselves and thus become like the Canaanites and doing what is right in our own eyes?
Edwin brings up a question. We'll kind of catch it in here in the catch-all teaching section. Sorry to back up. Is 4:8 supposed to call Moses to mind when he told God in Exodus 33 that he didn't want to go up if God didn't go with him? I would say that's more in the maybe category because it doesn't match the initial layers of the story. But as with all things, these echoes and things tie together. I do not put Barak in the same basket of Abraham, and so I don't necessarily see him engaging in that same way. But I'm not saying it's not a plausible way to read the text there in chapter 4, verse 8. Jared, if you want to comment real quick, then I'll offer some additional observations.
Yeah, I would say really quick, I think that there's something maybe to that, except, of course, who is he? He's changed God for a prophetess. He's changed God for a woman. He's exchanged God for, in some ways, an idol, right? So if it is reminiscent of that, it's not in a good way. But I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'd like to look at that more.
Yeah, I'll have to dig into the language a little bit there, pay attention to some other stuff. My initial inclination is I don't think so. It's not a straight Moses, Abrahamic type callback. Of course, yes. Doy also mentions the value of Shamgar because Shamgar pones all, if you want to use modern speech. So some things I think are interesting in this. I would lay out that one of the things I think is super interesting about this story is the use of uncommon saviors, if you will. These are individuals that certainly are not the kind of people we expect to do God's work. We expect paper-thin versions of David to do everything. Not the real David, but the one that we draw on our walls for VBSs that are just all those positive traits. That doesn't happen here. Secondly, God is using, even with a short narrative introduction, fully developed people in his work that are complex. And even Deborah and Jael have their fuller pictures shown out, that they're not these super puritanical people that just like flip a switch and it happens. They're involved in the messy, dirty parts of humanity in many ways. And I think that's a thing that I really like about the text. Thirdly, I think there's an important aspect of God is still telling the same story to us, that redemption is coming. And he's also hinting at, and I think this is one thing that I'll appreciate Edwin bringing in, is that it's opening the store for the redemption, for the story of the redemption of Christ in a new way. When you parallel the text of Ruth to Judges, then it begins to really become, oh, wow, there's a lot that happens in this phase that prepares for the arrival of the lineage of David. And there's a lot of that here. I think that's really great. And Edwin says contrast rather than comparison. I'd agree that's probably a better niche to think through. So what else we've got going in here? What do we learn about God in this section of the text too?
That God is willing to redeem his people. That God is using people like us, broken people, not heroes, not these champions who we think are perfect in every way. He's using people like us, people who are messed up and lack faith sometimes, but are ultimately in some ways willing to do what God says. And that's who God uses. Yeah. And he transforms them and he makes them his own people. And that to me is incredible because, you know, if we read the children's book version of Judges where everybody's perfect, then I would think God can't use me. Yeah. But when we read the real Judges, I think, okay, maybe I don't have an excuse. Maybe God can use me. Maybe, you know, I'm making excuses like Moses, not out of a sense of humility, but out of a sense of I don't want to do that and I'm going to make excuses. But God says, who made men's mouths to speak? And so if God tells me to do something, he's going to make it so that I can do it. And that is incredibly faith-affirming to me.
Tough question. I think it's an important one. One that we don't always know. Why is Barak showing up in Hebrews 11? Hebrews 11.
I feel like we should wait to talk about that Hebrews 11 when we get to Jephthah, who's the real issue.
Right. I'll offer a couple ways to think about that because that's a complex question. Hebrews 11 is subtitled by a lot of folks, Heroes of Faith. And so one of the ways in which we look at that and says, well, they must be perfect people. Well, clearly that's not the case. If you look at all of them, these aren't perfect people. Many of their sins are laid bare in their backgrounds. In the text of Hebrews 11, just off the top of my head, you have liars, adulterers, cheaters, killers across the board. So if you think about Galatians chapter 3 or any of the other accounts of spiritual rebellion, you know, where God says these things are bad, the text of Hebrews kind of is a catch-all for all of those things. All of the works of the flesh kind of appear in the life of the worthies that are there. Okay, then what? What else is he trying to teach? Well, those kind of people did things by faith. And even Barak, with prodding, he did things that were advancing the story of God. David was a man after God's own heart in two forms. One, he had a heart to go back to God, but he was also the kind of man God needed. He was the man, the right man for the job. And so why is Barak there and Deborah not in the sense of who gets the play? Let's talk part of that to God, but there's other things there too. Jared, one last comment there. We've got about a minute and a half left.
No, I think that's pretty much it. This is an incredibly rich section of text. I wish we had more time to talk about it. There's so much going on there. But, I mean, that, I think, is representative of the Bible as a whole. We're never going to get it all, mm-hmm. right? To quote one of my favorite TV shows from when I was growing up, don't take our word for it. Read it yourself, right?
Yeah.
I hope this is an encouragement for you guys to read Judges anew and to read Judges not just like the children's storybook version that we may have read when we were young and not gone in, but go again and realize the depth and the richness of God's word and how much it has to say for what we should do.
Yeah, slow or deliberate reading, sometimes careful reading, can really change the way you see the narrative portions of the Bible. And there's a lot going on there. I want to thank everyone for being part of the study today. We've got some great stuff planned going forward. We'll meet again for this Bible study Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Hope you guys can make it. All of these recordings are existing in a recorded format. And like Mike Wallace pointed out, maybe Barak is more important than we generally think. Just like there's more going on with Samson and everybody else. There's some stuff about him that isn't necessarily in the story of Judges that may be of value as well. That kind of shift, because all of it moves the story of God forward. We will be shutting the stream down here in just a second. Before we do so, I'm going to close this out with an opportunity to pray. And if you're part of the Eastside congregation or your congregation doesn't have an opportunity for you to be encouraged and exhorted, I'll be back live with some members of the Eastside Church at 10 a.m. Eastern, and you're more than welcome to be part of that time together. But right now, if you would pray with me, we're going to close out our study. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to approach your throne of grace and mercy. We thank you for the times that you have shown us the weaknesses of our lives so that we can grow into service. Give us courage and strength, and allow us to trust in your way above ours. Protect all of the hearts and souls who are struggling in the midst of whatever journey they're on, whether it be their flesh or their spirit. Give them strength and help all of us to see and to desire to be like Jesus. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen.
Amen.